Good afternoon, Eastern Washington. This is Matt Shea, and welcome to Patriot Radio, broadcasting live from the capital of Free Washington, Spokane Valley, brought to you once again by the committee to elect Matt Shea Republican in the legacy of Dr. Stan Monteith, bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news. It's not about right or left. It's about right and wrong, about our hope not being in man, but in Jesus Christ, and about not ending in prayer, but moving to action. As Ephesians 2, 5 through 6 says, God made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved and raised us up with him and seated us with him in the heavenly places. In Christ Jesus, amen and amen. Wow, the Kavanaugh stuff going on. Folks, I'm going to break some stuff down for you today so that you understand what is happening to us. This is going to be a prelude to an entire episode that I'm going to be spending on the Muslim Brotherhood. I'm going to be spending on the history of those who seek to destroy America. And I want to introduce some new terms to you today so that you understand what we are facing. Now, most of you have never heard of fourth generation warfare, fifth generation warfare, sixth generation warfare. Most of you haven't heard of any of those terms before. But I'm going to keep it simple. Instead of using kind of more military acronyms, what we are facing today in America are two counter states. That's the term I want you to remember, counter state. A counter state will set up quite literally a shadow government to take out America's enemies. And when the special forces would do that overseas, that's what they would do. Okay. A counter state would form in a country, shadow government would form in a country, and they would take out America's enemies, okay? And that was in the last century. That tactic, actually it's a strategy, excuse me, is being used here in America. There are two now counter states that quite literally have set up shadow governments in America. And I'm going to tell you who these are in a second. But I believe both of these shadow governments, both of these movements in America, are motivated by one thing, and that's evil. And I want to, many people have been asking me, what's going on? Who's doing this? I want to read to you a quote, actually a series of quotes. And then I'm going to tell you who said them, okay? And I will kind of explain where we are and where these folks really want to go and who is really behind this. Okay. Now, as Christians, we know who's behind this, and these quotes are going to drive this point home. All right. So, quote, I wish to avenge myself against the one, capital O, the one who rules above. The hellish vapors rise and fill the brain till I go mad and my heart is utterly changed. See this sword, the prince of darkness sold it to me. For me beats the time and gives the signs. Evermore boldly I play the dance of death. If there is something which devours, I'll leap within it, though I bring the world to ruins. The world which bulks between me and the abyss, I will smash to pieces with my enduring curses. I'll throw my arms around its harsh reality. Embracing me, the world will dumbly pass away and then sink down to utter nothingness, perished with no existence. That would be really living. Folks, that quote is from Karl Marx, the father of communism, the man largely responsible for the ideology that has killed tens of millions of people. I want to read another quote. quote, lest we forget, at least an over-the-shoulder acknowledgement to the very first radical from all our legends, mythology, and history, the first radical known to man who rebelled against the establishment and did it so effectively that he at least won his own kingdom, Lucifer. That is from Saul Alinsky, the modern American Marxist whose rules for radical is being followed to a T by the Marxists in America. Folks, what we are facing are two counterstates here in this country that quite literally have set up a shadow government. The first are the Marxists. The second is the Muslim Brotherhood, who, as a stated purpose, wants to overthrow American civilization by, quote, its own miserable hands, end quote, to establish a worldwide caliphate under Sharia law through civilization jihad. That is what we are facing today. And I know for a fact that President Trump has been briefed on both of these threats to the Constitution, but also to America. And ultimately, what we are facing behind both of these things is evil. We're facing evil. It's important, though, I think, to understand who we are. What is our identity? Now, I have heard a lot of people out there say America is not a Christian nation. There is no such thing as America. And I got to tell you something. These folks are so unread and uneducated that it should convict us that we need to be educating more. First, but secondly, we need to demand these folks read the primary source documents. So I want to go through a few of those right now, because this is who we are. This is our identity as Christians, as a country, as a nation, as states. It's what America is. And I don't want to get to this point where we're even having to argue the foundational issues. And you have some, there's a small group of people out there that try to claim, you know, these kind of notions that America and Christianity are not compatible, et cetera, et cetera. It's just not true. It's just absolutely not true. In fact, when Sir William Blackstone wrote his commentaries on the laws of England, you're talking between 1765, 1769. Okay, the American founders, that's within a decade of the Declaration of Independence and the first discussions about where do we go next. He defined the law as two things, the law of nature and the law of nature's God. That's why it was in the Declaration of Independence. And he described the law of nature as the inherent truth that God wrote into creation. He defined the law of nature's God as Holy Scripture. It's that simple, folks. That was the basis of jurisprudence in America, period. He was the second most quoted source behind the Bible by the founders. And the fact of the matter is, anybody who tries to argue that is lying to you. Straight up lying to you. And the reason that I can be so bold about that is because this was the natural progression in a long line of Christian documents, starting first with the Mayflower Compact on November 11th, 1620, as the Mayflower, the ship, was parked in the harbor. They compacted among themselves and with God and said the following, quote, "Having undertaken for the glory of God an advancement of the Christian faith, covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic," end quote. In 1641, so 21 years later, Nathaniel Ward wrote the Body of Liberties, and in that document laid out the laws for the colony that he's in and the biblical quote to back up the law. So again, the idea that there is no Judeo-Christian foundation to our legal system is just flat out wrong. The very first colonists that came here understood this. The founders understood this, and I'm going to get to some more documents here in a second. But interestingly enough, 2 years after that, in 1643, on May 19th, there was a confederation, an Articles of Confederation. Okay, now this is way before the First Continental Congress. There was an Article of Confederation of the United Colonies. So the colonies that were there in America at that time formed a confederation, and they had Articles of Confederation. Most people in America have never been taught any of this. And here is what the Articles of Confederation of the United Colonies on May 19th, 1643 says, quote, "Whereas we all, not some, we all came into these parts of America with one and the same end and aim, namely, to advance the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ and to enjoy the liberties of the gospel in purity with peace," end quote. 1643, then going into the 1700s, Sir William Blackstone, then to the Declaration of Independence, the law of nature and nature's God, that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable. You can't alienate them. You can't give them away. You can't ignore them. You can't sign them away. They are unalienable. They exist independent of your action. Okay? Then, shortly after, Karl Marx began writing in earnest about what would become communism. Okay? There was a controversy here that happened in the United States of America. And it was over chaplains in Congress. Now, it was broader than that. It was a challenge of whether America is a Christian nation. Okay, they actually asked the question. This is in the 1850s, okay? So Karl Marx has written his stuff, 1850s. And Congress actually took this up as a question. Yeah, they actually took up as a matter whether or not America is a Christian nation. Okay? So, I mean, this is just fascinating, the timing of everything. You just kind of put something in context for you. So, the 33rd Congress of the United States of America, House and Senate both, took on the question of whether or not America is a Christian nation. Okay? They did a congressional investigation on the issue. Here is the report published January 19th, 1853. Senator George Badger's report. Quote, "We are a Christian people from choice and education, and in a land thus universally Christian, what is to be expected, what desired, but that we should pay due regard to Christianity." Then, a year later, March 27th, 1854, Representative James Meacham came out with the House report. And here's what the House report said. Quote, "At the adoption of the Constitution, we believe every state, certainly 10 of 13, provided as regularly for the support of the church as for the support of the government, Down to the Revolution, every colony did sustain religion in some form. It was deemed particularly proper that the religion of liberty should be upheld by a free people. Had the people during the Revolution had a suspicion of any attempt to war against Christianity, that revolution would have been strangled in its cradle, end quote. As a congressional investigation concluded, America is a Christian nation. But it gets even better. People still tried to question this into the 1890s. So the United States Supreme Court actually took up this question. Is America a Christian nation? Church of the Holy Trinity versus U.S. It's 143 U.S. 457. Okay, I want to read from this court case. The United States Supreme Court found as a matter of fact and law the following. Quote, no purpose of action against religion can be imputed to any legislation, state or national, because this is a religious people. This is a Christian nation. There is no dissonance in these declarations. There is a universal language pervading them all, having one meaning. They affirm and reaffirm that this is a religious nation. These are not individual sayings, declarations of private persons. These are organic, legal, governmental utterances. They speak the voice of the entire people. These and many other matters which might be noticed. Add a volume of unofficial declarations to the mass of organic utterances that this is a Christian nation. End quote. Congress found we were a Christian nation. The United States Supreme Court found we were a Christian nation. The founding documents that I read, the legal precedent, as far as precedent in the good sense, discovering what natural law and the law of nature's God means, all of it says we're a Christian nation. So people ask me, what is the solution to these counterstates that are coming against America? And the answer is very simple. We need to reclaim our identity as a Christian nation. We need to reclaim our identity as sons and daughters of the living God. We need to stand firm as Americans on what made America great. As the atheist communist Chinese did in an official study, they discovered that Christianity was a reason that America was great. And I've read that here on the show before. But for all of us individually, we need to make that decision. Who are we? And if who we are is good in Christ Jesus, not in our own, but in Christ Jesus, and we truly are sons and daughters of the living God, then we need to start acting like it. Because the counterstate of both the Muslim Brotherhood and the Marxists that is coming against this country seeks the destruction of the Constitution and the destruction of Christianity, as the Marxists and the Muslim Brotherhood always have. And for us, we need to, in this time, stand in the gap. Well, that brings us now to your daily intelligence briefing. On the international front, Venezuela, 40% of businesses closed down there thanks to the New American Investigation. Talking about that, you know, we've been talking about the 1,000,000% inflation, removing the zeros to zero as a currency. Bottom line is this. President Trump hit the nail on the head the other day at the United Nations. Look, Venezuela is one of the richest countries, and they had all this massive oil wealth, and socialism destroyed it. And now it's just a massive humanitarian disaster. And so all those that seek socialism seek, again, misery and destruction. That's what they are advocating. Now, they may not intentionally be advocating that, I grant you. But the system itself is so fundamentally flawed that that's what the result always will be. Always. China. Heard a report this last week, and I'm trying to confirm this, that China actually holds the launch codes to the nuclear weapons in North Korea, which is very interesting that that finally came out. I'm going to try to confirm that that's actually the case, but I heard it from some very, very trustworthy sources at some pretty high levels. So anyway, that's a kind of an interesting geostrategic issue. Also on the national front or the international front. So I told you that when I found out how the alignment in the Middle East was going to end up being, I would tell you, here is what it is. It looks like now it's the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Bahrain versus Iran, Turkey, and Qatar. Turkey is positioning itself, specifically Erdogan, is positioning himself to reestablish the caliphate in Turkey. Now, for those of you that don't know the history, the last Islamic caliphate was abolished in 1924 by Kemal Ataturk, or the father of the Turks. He secularized the country. Many that I have talked to believe that the coup in Turkey actually was a last gasp of the secular remnants of the army. They can't prove that, but that's kind of the general thinking. Turkey, then, interestingly enough, the Ottoman Empire ended there. In 1928, Hassan al-Banna started the Muslim Brotherhood to reestablish the caliphate and to impose Sharia law, again, through civilization jihad. So this is the timing, the history of how things are operating. Now, it is looking like there, the alignings that are happening over there, that Turkey is positioning itself to be reestablish that caliphate that ended there. Saudi Arabia is just trying to hold on to its kingdom right now. And it's very interesting that Iran, as the Shia, so Turkey is Sunni, the Shia, Iran, are also stepping up their game. Now, fundamentally, you talk about the Sunni-Shia split. They work together, okay? When they think they're against a common enemy, like the United States or Israel, Sunnis and Shias will work. They'll work together. Where you have conflict is where they start fighting over who's in control of a certain area. Okay, so I hope that kind of clarifies things. I actually met a sheikh over in Iraq. He was Shia and his wife was Sunni. Okay, so don't get that in your mind too solidly, because it's a very fluid thing over in the Middle East. But interestingly enough, Iran, we talked about the spying scandal and the fact that two spies were arrested here, that they're doing war games in the Hormuz. But Debka File today is talking about the fact that the Iranians actually did an unimpeded drone missile strike in eastern Syria. So that's a strategic change and worthy of note. Also on the international front, I talked about this forced euthanasia happening. Unbelievable. Because older people don't have anything to give. Of course they do. They have wisdom to give. Every life is valuable. Imago Dei, in the image of God. Crazy stuff. On the national front, there's an acknowledgement that we are in a very, very cold sun cycle. So it's called a solar minimum. And that the temperature in the thermosphere is so cold it may break a record. Okay. So we're actually in a cooling period, pretty well, I think, conclusively proven. And that too coming to us from, again, scientific observers. Also on the national front, talk about some of these threats that are happening. First of all, there's a lot of talk about electromagnetic storms and things. Okay, this different technically than a sunspot, all right? But Peter Pry, former CIA analyst and author of the book EMP Manhattan Project, is urging the government to rapidly harden the U.S. electric power system against EMP, similar to the three-year crash program to build the first atomic bomb in 1942. And why is that? Because it's so easy to harden our grid, but and it's cheap, too. But if we don't, the results are catastrophic. You lose refrigeration, you lose medicine, you lose the ability to pump water, you lose, especially in the southern states, air conditioning, all these kind of things. So he's talking about this now. And I think it is something that we need to pay attention to. Also on the national front, this other threat, you know, coming from the Marxists. You have people continuing to promote violence. Maxine Waters, again, openly threatened President Donald Trump. This coming to us from Understanding the Threat. And folks, if you don't know this website, Understanding the Threat, you need to go there. They have a lot of great stuff and resources there, and you can read up on it yourself. But here is what is said, okay? Quote, there are those who say, what if we get rid of him? Then we have got the vice president, and he'll be worse. I say, knock off the first one and then go after the second one. Okay, that's from Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Again, these threats that are coming forward and no action seems to be taken. It's crazy. Which brings us to the regional front and these allegations. So you've got allegations now against Joe Fain. You have one other member of the House resigning. And it seems like nobody is investigating these allegations that were brought up in regards to the Democrat Speaker Pro Tem. And even though the media has some of this stuff, and the media, to a great extent, has been sitting on some of it. So what we're seeing, too, is really a double standard. You know, with Kavanaugh, you got very weak allegations. And anyway, all this tells me that we have to come back local and, again, understand who we are. On the local front as well, Death of a Nation was playing up in Colville. That's Dinesh D'Souza's new movie. You got to watch it. It is a must watch. It details how fascism, socialism, national socialism, or Nazism, communism, all of those are on the left side of the spectrum. In fact, he interviews Richard Spencer, this so-called white nationalist, and he admits on camera he's a progressive. In his own words, he admits it. He says, if that's what a progressive is, then I'm a progressive. Quote, unquote. Okay? And yet, locally, we're seeing certain people who are self-identifying as socialists and Democrats. Even if they try to claim publicly they're not, they're self-identifying when they're using tactics like this, when they try to smear people as fascists, knowing that that actually is a leftist economic system. Okay. All right. Also on the local front, Sandinista Lisa Brown. And yes, the articles have come out showing that, again, she actually sympathized with the communist Sandinistas back in the day. That's probably the best evidence that she should not be in Congress. Also on the local front, Alex Newman coming October 11th with his brief War on America. If you have missed all of these briefings that have happened over the summer, you've got to go to this one, October 11th, Center Place in Spokane Valley. Get there early. I think it starts officially, I think it's 6 o'clock, but get there early. War on America, Alex Newman. You're going to want to hear, again, some very clear details about who is doing this at the national level. And that's the briefing. Remember, the antidote to dependency and socialism is to be a God-fearing, self-reliant, freedom-loving American. Thank you to everybody that's been praying for me and Victoria and the show. And if you get the chance, you can go to VoteShea.com. Also, you can catch us on Patriot Radio's iTunes page and also our Podbean page, Podbean. Well, we're going to be talking about a subject today that a lot of people have tried to shove into the back corner, say it doesn't exist, say it's just fear-mongering and conspiracy theory, when in fact the evidence continues to mount that it is not. My guest today is J.B. Hanley. He's the author of How to End the autism epidemic. He is the co-founder and chairman of Generation Rescue, a nonprofit organization focused on helping children recover from autism. And also, he's the co-producer of the documentary film Autism Yesterday and the co-founder of the Age of Autism blog. Well, JB, thanks for joining me on Patriot Radio today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I've been really excited to get you on and get the truth out about this. So I just want to kind of jump right in. But first, how did you get involved in all of this? And what is your background a little bit to give the listeners an idea of why this became an important issue for you?
You know, I went to Stanford. I started my own private equity fund, which I ran for 2 decades. My wife went to Stanford. We were about as mainstream a couple as you could possibly get. My middle son, we entrusted his health to our pediatrician 100% and didn't think twice about any recommendations made. And his health started to decline dramatically after each vaccine appointment. Around a year of age, his neurological health started to decline as well. So we had a child whose gastrointestinal system was a mess. His immune system was a mess. He was constantly having ear infections, and he started doing having really unusual mannerisms, et cetera. We were living in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time, and so we went to UCSF, which University of California, San Francisco, to get my son diagnosed with autism. They told us it was a lifelong condition. There was really nothing we could do. He'd probably be institutionalized. And we were already reading online about alternatives. We were very, very concerned about our son, to say the least. And 30 miles away, there was a doctor called a Dan doctor, and she gave us a completely different view of the world. She said that vaccines were a primary trigger, that children were recovering, that you had to treat the physical symptoms, that they were manifesting. If you did, the neurological symptoms would go away. And so we got put at a fork in the road. And the explanation that made a lot more sense was that these vaccines had injured my son. They had caused brain damage. They had caused gut damage. And if we addressed those issues, we might see a resolution of some or all of his symptoms. And so we got put on that fork in the road in about 2004, and we've never looked back. And you made a point that I was listening in on. The biological evidence, the scientific evidence today for exactly how a vaccine causes autism is becoming more and more clear. They're doing animal studies where they inject these animals with different components of the vaccine, and they find profound neurological damage. And that's part of what my book talks about, is the science. By the way, none of it's done in the U.S. It's all done by scientists in places like China, Canada, United Kingdom, France. These scientists are trying to raise the flag to warn parents of what's going on, but of course they're being drowned out by Big Pharma.
Well, let's talk about that because, you know, I have run into this in the legislature. I've run into it just talking to normal people. They say this is already settled. There, you know, vaccines do not cause autism.
Yep.
What would you offer as both not just the medical but the legal proof that vaccines do indeed cause autism?
Right. So first off, the science they're referring to is so weak and so limited, and anybody who takes 10 extra minutes to look would agree with me. They've looked at one vaccine ingredient, thimerosal, which is a form of mercury, and they've looked at one vaccine, the MMR vaccine. That's it. That's all that's ever been studied, and it's all been through what we call epidemiology, which is looking at numbers on spreadsheets. Meanwhile, we have this compelling biological evidence that clearly shows exactly how a vaccine can cause brain damage in a rat, and you can translate that to humans, et cetera. The new information that's in my book is that the main expert witness for the government in 2009, when the vaccine court, which no one's ever heard of, effectively heard a case of 5,000 parents who all claim their child's autism was caused by a vaccine. The expert for the government, meaning the expert against these parents, changed his mind after looking at enough children. This is the head researcher at the Kennedy Krieger Institute at Johns Hopkins. Under sworn deposition, he now says vaccines can cause autism in vulnerable children. Vulnerable children are children who are suffering from some kind of depletion of cellular energy, and if they get vaccinated with multiple vaccinations during that time period, they're at grave risk of developing autism. So we have the most mainstream autism scientist in the world. His name is Dr. Andrew Zimmerman. He's from the Kennedy Krieger Institute at Johns Hopkins University, and he and his colleagues are now saying under oath that vulnerable kids can get autism from their vaccines. It's groundbreaking stuff, and of course the mainstream media is not touching this story.
Well, no, and for obvious reasons, a lot of politicians are not touching this either.
They're scared, and they're often misinformed by lobbyists working for big pharma. Yeah, I'll give you a great example, and this is something that most parents really don't understand or appreciate. In the mid-1980s, there were three licensed vaccines in the United States, MMR, DTP, and polio. That's it. And the average vaccination rate for a child in the United States of those three vaccines in the mid-1980s was between 50 and 60%. Today, we have 11 separate vaccines given 38 times by the time a child is five, and the average vaccination rate is 90%. But you get these crazy scaremongering stories about herd immunity that make no sense. First of all, in the mid-1980s, children were not dying in the streets from infectious diseases, and we only gave three vaccines and had dramatically lower vaccination rates. But as importantly, the average American adult, under 50%, are actually vaccinated. And vaccines wane typically in 4 to 10 years. And so you get these politicians all lathered up about how our schools, you know, everyone needs to be vaccinated. They have no idea what the vaccination rates are, the teachers or the parents or the janitors or the service providers or the adults that the child will see at a mall after school or the coaches or anything else. It's absurd that they use this notion of herd immunity as the reason we all need to get vaccinated when we've never been in vaccine-derived herd immunity. It's an impossibility just mathematically. So that history and that perspective is often missing for most politicians who I listen to, and it's too bad because they're being misinformed, and the consequences for our children now are very grave. And I want to make another point. Not only is the biological science now clear about how a vaccine can trigger autism, but the biological science on how a vaccine can trigger autoimmunity is very, very firm and very, very clear. And autoimmunity is everything from asthma to diabetes to food allergies, which, as you know, are chronic in our children and epidemic in our children. 54% of American children have a chronic disease. Vaccines appear, based on the science, to be the primary trigger of all that autoimmunity as well. And that science isn't even up for debate. It's clear as day, but you never hear about that when you're listening to pharma's reps try to make vaccines mandatory in state houses all over the country. It's really dispiriting to see how little of the truth is shared with the average elected official.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the common arguments, you know, and I've heard this too. There's no such thing as an autism epidemic. How do you respond to that?
I mean, it's utter insanity. There's no science that supports that contention. It is a widely told fable, but I have an entire chapter that I devote to all the clear, unequivocal, published science on the prevalence of autism over time. We had statewide extremely detailed studies done back in the 70s and the 80s that showed under no uncertain terms that the autism rate back then was about 1 in 10,000. Today, it's 1 in 36 children. And step by step over the years, I showed documented study after documented study after documented study that shows a clear, real rise in prevalence. So that's just a wives' tale. It's gotten so bad that two of the leaders of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control's own network for counting autism cases, have raised their hand to say, we got a problem here. The head of the New Jersey network said, I don't understand why the media is not reporting how bad the rise in prevalence really is. And the head of the Utah Study Center filed a whistleblower lawsuit claiming that the CDC was putting pressure on her to keep the number down because it keeps rising. So there's just no truth to when people say that autism's always been with us. And you ask any teacher, any coach, anybody who was around 20, 30, 40 years ago, there are way more affected children today. There's simply no doubt about it, and the science fully supports that.
So let's talk a little bit, too, about the idea that autism in the next 10 years is not just going to become an epidemic, it's going to become a crisis in our communities. What are the projections and predictions?
Well, I mean, you hear people say that 1 in 2 children will have autism within 20 years, but let's be very clear about something. It's already a crisis. The average public school in America has somewhere between 15 and 25% of their children in special education. They're bursting at the seams with their budgets. And what we have is a federal program the CDC implements, but then the states end up carrying the load, right? The states pay for health care for the children. The states pay for the public school system, et cetera. Our public schools are bursting with children with learning disabilities and mental challenges that don't look anything like the schools looked 30 or 40 years ago. And autism is really the tip of the iceberg, in my opinion. And the science shows very clearly that things like anxiety, depression, et cetera, are caused by inflammation in the brain, which is exactly what a vaccine does. And so the science more and more is pointing very clearly to how these children are getting sick. And I want to bring up another quick point. We don't test vaccines next to a placebo. We test them in a group of children, and we monitor safety for 5 or 10 days after they receive the vaccine. The first study out of China to ever look at a vaccine against a placebo was done with the hepatitis B vaccine, which is the first vaccine most American children receive. And one of the things they learned, beyond the fact that the hepatitis B vaccine causes severe brain damage, was that there is a latency period before the vaccine damage manifests. What that means is that a child might get a vaccine at 2 months of age, but the learning disability shows up when they're 4. We would never know that because we don't test for that. And so there's very disturbing new science done in animal models in other countries that is giving us a very clear guidance as to what's happening to our children.
There are some people that I've run into that say, well, you know, autism really is just because we have better diagnosis today.
Yeah.
There really isn't truly an expansion in practicality. It's just a matter of better diagnosis. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, the data doesn't support that at all. And I want to make another point. Autism has also, you know, you have like the Good Doctor TV show, and I make the point in my book that the good doctor who, you know, apparently has autism is like a guy with a cane representing paraplegics. It's wonderful if somebody with autism could be a physician, but 50% of children with autism don't speak. 30% of children with autism have epilepsy or seizure disorder. The overwhelming majority of children with autism will never live alone. They'll never get married. They'll never go to college, and they'll never hold down a job. It is a devastating mental disability, which speaks to the point these children weren't hiding 20 or 30 years ago. You would have recognized them if they were sitting in the classroom next to you. The data shows unequivocally they didn't exist back then in the numbers anywhere near what they do today. It is a genuine and real epidemic, and you have to recognize the reason why there's such a fight over acknowledging there's an epidemic. If you acknowledge that the rise is real, which all the science supports that it is, then you have to find a cause. And if you have to find a cause, we all know the first place you have to look is the very things that are being shown time and time again to cause the brain damage that leads to autism.
Well, and I think that's what's so disgusting about some of the rebuttals is they try to blame it on reclassification of mental retardation and things like that. I mean, it's offensive to me anyway.
Well, what's interesting about all those, and I do agree with you as a parent, but as more of an empiricist, what I would say are those are testable hypotheses, right? So if you want to make the argument that, hey, we reclassified mental retarded, okay, let's go look at the numbers. And this is where it's so disturbing. The science is clear. It's not a reclassification. They went through those studies. I cite all the published studies in my book. It's a clear, unequivocal, real rise. Anybody really in the know knows that, and I think one of the really disturbing things when you peel back the onion a few layers is that oftentimes the person that you find who's fanning the flames of this sort of epidemic denialism is related to the vaccine industry. Shouldn't surprise you too much, but it's still disturbing when you realize the very people fanning the flames of claiming there's no epidemic are tied into the vaccine makers, and there's a reason for that. I genuinely believe, because they have to be monitoring the science just the way I am, that they know they have a very, very serious problem. The scale of destruction against our children is nearly incomprehensible. The cost of that destruction is nearly incomprehensible. And you can imagine, much as they did with tobacco and lung cancer, that unfortunately profit-seeking industries will seek to delay that day of reckoning, which I hope to accelerate by exposing how clear the evidence is showing that what parents have been saying all along is actually true. And I bring this point up with people. How many times in the history of mankind has an entire group of people, and I mean there are tens of thousands of us parents saying the same thing, how many times have an entire group of people been saying we were injured by this product, and meanwhile all the people who profit from that product are telling us, no, that's not what happened? How many times were the profit makers telling the truth in retrospect? How many times has that happened? You can pick lead paint, lead in gasoline, Vioxx, thalidomide. I mean, the list is literally dozens long. When has the profit-seeking industry ever turned out to be telling the truth?
That's a great rhetorical question. It is.
I can't think of one. I can't think of one either. I mean, there are tens of thousands of us. I have met so many parents. We share the exact same story. a stair-step decline in our children's physical health after each vaccine appointment that led to an autism diagnosis. And then, lo and behold, when we treat our children not for autism but for vaccine injury, they get better. Many of our kids recover if medically treated properly for vaccine injury. Think about that for a moment. We're literally going in and trying to undo the damage the vaccine caused. Most people don't appreciate there's a whole group of doctors who specialize in treating children with autism, but what they actually specialize in is treating children with vaccine injury.
There's always an argument that people try to end conversations with, at least in Olympia, and that is, the science is settled on this, vaccines are safe and effective, and I just as a comment, science is a method, it's not a consensus, and that just drives me nuts every time I hear it. But how do you respond to that in your book?
Yeah, I know. Well, it's funny because, I mentioned earlier that they've only looked at one vaccine and one ingredient for their relationship to autism. And so whenever somebody says to me the science is settled, I just say, please cite the study that you rely upon to make that statement. They can never come up with anything beyond a single ingredient or a single vaccine. And so I think just going one layer deeper allows someone to realize how much they're lying when they say that. And it's repeated so often that I think most people saying it have no idea what they're talking about. But in my book is an entire chapter on all the biological science that shows clear as day how a vaccine causes brain damage. And in a separate chapter, I expose how weak the science that people make that statement are really relying upon. There's nothing to it. And it's sad that the CDC, with as little work as they've done, will actually make that statement. And very recently, a number of scientists from other countries wrote letters to the CDC, and I talk about this in my book, scientists who'd done biological science showing how a vaccine can cause harm to the brains of animals. They wrote a letter to the CDC, our Centers for Disease Control, saying, here's all this new science, we want you to take a look, and we believe that the statements you have on your website right now that vaccines are not causing autism is inaccurate and needs to be reconsidered. You compound that with the leading mainstream autism scientists from the Kennedy Krieger Institute at Johns Hopkins saying the same thing, and I would argue that anybody who takes my book from start to finish will never feel the same way about the vaccine autism debate again. And I hope that politicians, even those who've publicly stated that this issue's over, will be willing to read this book. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is about to mail my book to all 7,383 elected state officials in the United States, hoping they'll take a read of the book and what it's telling them about America's children.
That's absolutely fantastic that he's doing that. And I appreciate that type of approach to things where you're getting the information in the hands of everybody. Can't make them read it, but you're getting them in the
literally in their including hands. His yeah. private email address in a letter to each legislator, hoping
wow.
that they'll take the time to read it and talk to him about it and stop
and
listening to the pharma lobbyists.
Yeah, exactly. Stop listening to them. Well, let's spend the rest of the show talking about there's people listening to the show right now that have vaccine injured children.
Yeah.
What can they do? How do they get help? What are the steps? How do you take them forward?
It's a great question, and it's really where my passion is. I have to talk about all this vaccine stuff because that's causation, but we have children recovering from autism and going on to lead normal lives. The first thing I would tell a parent to do is go to a website called medmaps.org. So it's medmaps.org, and that's an organization. I'm not affiliated with them, but they are a group of doctors who treat children with autism through what we call biomedical intervention, meaning we treat the symptoms that they're exhibiting, and we see their neurology get better. So the first thing I would do is find a qualified doctor on medmaps.org. There are many in the Pacific Northwest to choose from. And then the first and most important thing I tell a parent to do, we see so many children's neurology improve through simple dietary intervention. And what I mean by that is the removal of gluten first and dairy second from many children's diets has an almost immediate and dramatic impact on that child's cognition, concentration, eye contact, etc. So time and again, I've heard how great the diet can be for a child. So I would encourage anybody on the fence, skeptical, not sure, just pull gluten for 2 or 3 weeks. There's so many gluten substitutes nowadays. You can get bagels and bread and pancake mix and everything in a gluten-free form. Just pull gluten for a few weeks. Watch your child very closely and see if any of their symptoms improve. Once parents see that, they get on board with the idea that I can medically treat my child and watch their autism symptoms subside. So I think that's the best advice I could give a parent as a way to start. But I really encourage them to have a health professional who specializes in this area working alongside them and guiding them through the process.
So you have parents out there right now that, you know, the diet thing is a great step forward. What is the mechanism that is causing this? Is it an autoimmune response? Is it heavy metal? I mean, what is the mechanism generally? And I'm not asking you to make a medical
opinion,
but generally.
I'll try to take you there without weighing down the audience too much. What we have learned is that immune activation events in the brain of babies cause autism. What an immune activation event means is that the brain is reacting something that enters the brain that shouldn't be there. We believe the primary agent is the aluminum adjuvant that's used in vaccines. The immune activation event creates inflammation in the brain, okay? Inflammation in the brain can either halt neuronal pairing just as it's happening when a brain is developing, and or the inflammation can just get in the way of normal brain processing. So anything you can do to reduce the amount of brain inflammation going on will likely produce a better brain. And so for a variety of reasons, gluten is very inflammatory for many people, right? So if you reduce that inflammatory substance from the body, the brain should be able to function better. And so many of the things that these doctors do are specifically to reduce neuroinflammation, to try to get what's in the brain out and to try to get the brain's inflammation decreased. And so that's where we see the best results.
Wow. I'm just so excited that now we can have this conversation. We can talk about the science. We can talk about the legal underpinnings behind it. The fact that every state legislator in the country is going to be getting the book. But for everybody listening to the show, where can they go to get the book? Where can they go to get more information, learn about you, maybe even contact you if they have a problem?
Yeah, so I have a blog that I maintain called J.B. Handley, H-A-N-D-L-E-Y, blog. So jbhandleyblog.com. You can read my articles up there. You can send me an email, et cetera. My book, How to End the Autism Epidemic, is available on Amazon. We made the top 40 on Amazon last week despite zero mainstream media, so people are definitely listening, and so I would really encourage people to read the book. And I want to offer one final thing up. Dr. Andrew Zimmerman, who I've talked about from Kennedy Krieger, he just filed an affidavit alleging judicial misconduct on the part of the vaccine court from the 2009 ruling against 5,500 families alleging that vaccines cause autism. He basically says that the Justice Department buried evidence that would have proven that vaccines, in fact, do cause autism. So this is an ongoing story. Robert F. Kennedy is actually involved with that filing, and I hope that justice is served for those families soon. But that's another thing for parents to check out. This is a story that's moving as we speak.
Wow. That's incredible. Would you be willing to come out to Washington State to talk to some of the folks out here? And maybe even if we get to the point where they actually give us a hearing, testify in front of the legislature.
I'd be thrilled. I'd particularly like to talk to legislators who'd actually read the book, but I'd talk to anybody about this topic.
Now, for young parents that are out there right now that are listening, maybe they have a baby that's due, what would be your advice to them on handling the whole situation? Because vaccines are pushed just with almost strong-arm tactics in some cases.
They are. It's very today. Scary. It's very scary for parents. I understand. I was one of them. And we all want to do the right thing. We want to keep our baby safe. And I would tell them that there's a wonderful book by a pediatrician who's based in Portland, where I live. His name is Paul Thomas, and the book is called The Vaccine Friendly Plan. I would tell them to read that book. I'd tell them to read my book. Dr. Paul Thomas, a pediatrician here in Portland, he actually vaccinates his patient population in a very, very different way. And by doing so, he's seen no autism. In a 2,000-patient population, he stopped giving the hepatitis B. He delayed the MMR vaccine till the children are three. It's supposed to be given at 13 months. He made some other adjustments to the schedule. And, you know, you should have had 3% of those 2,000 kids with autism, so you should have had 60. Instead, he had zero. And so I think that some adjustments to the schedule can maybe meet both needs of protecting children from serious diseases and at the same time protecting them from bad neurology as well. So I think parents should do their own research. Don't let your doctor pressure you. Hopefully find a doctor who's more open-minded, more willing to work with you, a doctor who might be willing to read my book or read Dr. Thomas's book. And I would just tell you, take your time. Be patient. Do your research. Don't ever let somebody guilt you into. Remember that a vaccine is a medical procedure. It's a medical procedure. You should take it as seriously as you would take surgery that your child was going to go under. You should do all the research. You should be skeptical of how much they're willing to talk to you about the risks. You should do your own work. These are all things I wish I had done and didn't. I ceded all those decisions to my pediatrician, and my wife and I have paid a very, very serious price for that. My son has paid the most extreme price of all.
Thank you very much. J.B. Hanley, I really appreciate you. We want to have you on the radio again. Keep up the great work. And, man, I'm just so excited to have you on, and I'm just so excited that you're taking this to the next level. So however I can help you, let me know.
I shudder that I have to say this, but thank you for having the courage to talk about this issue. It's sad that there are so few, but you are one who's willing to talk about it, and that's really, really important. So thank you.
Amen. Well, be blessed and keep up the fight. J.B. Hanley on Patriot Radio, How to End the Autism Epidemic. If you want to go get that book, just message me on Facebook. I think I'm going to post it here real quick, too, for the website. But you've got to read it, especially if you're a parent, especially if you've heard of somebody that says, oh, this is not true. Read what has been compiled. It is an overwhelming case at this point. And as always, it seems like policy catches up to science and reality, at least in the legislatures across the country. But for you and for your family, you can take the truth. You can act on it now. And again, How to End the Autism Epidemic, J.B. Hanley, and just a phenomenal work. And I'm really glad that some of the folks here locally put me in touch with him, because this is kind of the missing piece that I've been looking for a while. This is Matt Shea. Thank you once again for joining me on Patriot Radio today. Remember, we're a Christian nation, sons and daughters of the living God. Let's embrace our identity as that and spread the love. And may he make this generation truly the greatest one.